The life of the prophet Samuel was a stream of unbroken faithfulness. Plot Samuel's years on a timeline, and you'll find no breaks for rebellion, no seasons of sowing wild oats, no lapses of spiritual laziness, no bouts with moral compromise. Samuel's mother dedicated him to God from his infancy, and Samuel remained devoted to the Lord for the remainder of his long life. Samuel's life is an example of what I call compound godliness. Now, when you open up a money market at the local bank, you expect to benefit from some compound interest. The money you make makes more money. The interest rolls back into the investment. It feeds on itself. It builds and grows and snowballs. And the same principle applies to spiritual investments. The person who lives for God receives compound benefits. A heart devoted to purity grows increasingly pure. A mind fixed on heavenly thoughts becomes more and more elevated in its thinking. A will bent toward God grows in the direction of that bend. It leans out further towards God. A spirit willing to muster faith adds muscle to that faith. Jesus says in Luke chapter 8, verse 18, "Whoever has, to him more will be given." This was Samuel. Years of compounded purity and loyalty and faith and listening to God all added up. It compounded into a man of character. This man, Samuel, was a man of integrity and spiritual stature. His years of godly living had bestowed on Samuel an authority that enabled him to hold this nation in check and to usher in a new age in Israel's history. In Jeremiah chapter 15, verse 1, the Lord is bemoaning the sin of a future generation when he makes this statement: "Even if Moses and Samuel stood before me, my mind would not be favorable toward this people." Notice, though, God himself lumps Moses and Samuel into the same category. Both were powerful intercessors. Guys, here's why young people particularly need to live your life for Jesus. It's because faithfulness compounds like interest. A life devoted to Jesus at an early age not only benefits you now, but the years of godly living will grow into a stature and an authority that God will use mightily. Make too many withdrawals from God. Don't let godliness have an opportunity to accrue. Create too many lapses on the timeline, and you will certainly lose out. In the days of Samuel, God needed a man of stature and influence to lead the nation through a transition period. You see, Samuel was the last judge, and he was the first prophet. The prophets were men that God would raise up to speak his word to the kings of Israel. Samuel was the prophet who oversaw the beginnings of Israel's monarchy. He anointed the first two kings, Saul and David, and he gave them needed instruction. Samuel's ministry was similar to the ministry of John the Baptist. Both were lifelong Nazarites, and both were forerunners of Davidic kings. Samuel served David first in that divinely appointed lineage, whereas John served Jesus, the last of that same lineage, and of course heir to the promises of God that he had made to David. Samuel is often called the prophet of prayer, and on several occasions we'll see him rallying the nation to pray. As we read in Jeremiah 15, he was a mighty intercessor. In fact, when he died, the entire nation gathered to Samuel's home in Ramah to mourn his death. The people of Israel loved Samuel because they knew that he had loved them. Well, the story of Samuel begins in chapter 1. And if you don't have a Bible, raise your hand. We'll make sure that you get one. Anybody need a Bible? Larry, this young lady right down here. Great. Chapter 1. "Now there was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim of the mountains of Ephraim. And his name was Elkanah, the son of Jerohom, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuf, an Ephraimite. And he had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, and the name of the other, Penina. Good southern girl, Penina. Penina had children, but Hannah had no children. Once Mark Twain was challenged by a bigamous Mormon to quote a verse that would prohibit bigamy. Twain answered, "That's easy. No man can serve two masters." God's ideal for marriage was one man and one woman in a lifelong relationship. God tolerated polygamy or bigamy as he does divorce today, but it was never his intention. Recently, Middle Eastern archaeologists have unearthed a cuneiform tablet. Maybe you've read about this in the news. That what they deciphered and they read, and it was entitled, "The Top 10 Reasons No Man in His Right Mind Would Want Two Wives." And here's the translation from the ancient Semitic Chaldean. Number 10, twice as many birthdays and anniversaries to remember. Number 9, you have to pick who gets the second garage door opener. Number 8, by the time two wives take a shower, there's no more hot water. Number 7, who can afford 2 dozen roses on Valentine's Day? Number 6, when it comes to choices, it's now 2 against 1. Number 5, your 1 drawer and half a foot of closet space gets cut in half. Number 4, 2 honeydew lists. Number 3, do you really want to decide who gets the master bedroom? Number 2, 2 mother-in-laws. And the number 1 reason no man in his right mind would want 2 wives, PMS twice a month. Well, apparently Elkanah had never enlisted, for if he had, he would have added 1 more reason why 2 wives are not a good idea. They might not get along. Polygamy can spawn fierce competition. It doesn't take long for brides to become rivals. The husband and kids end up caught in the middle of wifely warfare. Verse 3 tells us, "This man went up from his city yearly to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. Also the 2 sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. Elkanah and his family would make their annual pilgrimage to the tabernacle. They would go up to observe the Jewish feast. And whenever the time came for Elkanah to make an offering, he would give portions to Penina his wife and to all her sons and daughters, but to Hannah he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah, although the Lord had closed her womb." What a provocative comment. The Lord had closed her womb. Did you know that God is sovereign over all things, including human conception? The Lord can close a womb. The Lord can open a womb. And at times, He will do both. Childbearing couples need to trust the Lord. Hannah loved the Lord. She was a godly woman. If all Hannah had to cope with was God's will for her life, she probably wouldn't have gotten so upset. Hannah could trust the Lord exclusively, but it was this Penina that was causing all the trouble in her life. Verse 6, "And her rival also provoked her severely to make her miserable because the Lord had closed her womb." This phrase, "to make her miserable," could be translated "to violently agitate." Literally, it refers to a thunder clash. In other words, Hannah was an emotional storm because of Penina. In ancient times, barrenness was the heaviest burden that a woman could bear. It carried the stigma of a curse, but the digs from her rival had made matters worse. Well, there's no doubt that Penina was a jerk. But Elkanah had exacerbated the problem. You see, he loved Hannah, and he hated to see her suffer. And so to compensate, Elkanah gave her these special favors. At the tabernacle, it was a double portion of the sacrifice. But I imagine Elkanah gave Hannah twice as much of everything. Probably twice his time and twice the grocery money and 2 weeks of vacation to Peninnah's one and double the mad money and one of those minivans with the two sliding side doors rather than Peninnah's traditional model. And how do you think Peninnah reacted to Elkanah's extra shows of affection? She hated it. And she retaliated by bombarding Hannah with little cutting comments, little biting barbs. Peninnah would brag about how well her children were doing in front of Hannah. And then she would make comments like, "And what about your kids? Oops, I'm sorry." I'm sure it was all that Hannah could do to keep from slapping the old girl silly. Spilling coffee in her lap or something. And so it was, catch this, year by year, long year. Can you imagine? When she went up to the house of the Lord, that she provoked her, therefore she wept and did not eat. Hannah could steer clear of Peninnah around the house. She managed to live a separate life. Her daily routine avoided contact with her rival, but once a year, these two wives shared a common space. Every year, Elkanah loaded up the family in the minivan and made his pilgrimage to Shiloh, where he worshiped God at the tabernacle. And this is where the sparks would fly between Hannah and Peninnah. Every chance she got, Peninnah would stick it to Hannah. Another dig, another poke, another slap in the face. Hannah loved God, but boy, did she hate these trips. The conflict between her and Peninnah spoiled her worship. It distracted her focus from the Lord. What should have been a joyous occasion, a joyous celebration, ended up being a miserable time of exasperation. I'm sure that Peninnah would have preferred to just stay home alone. But the tabernacle was God's house. It was Hannah's duty to meet with others and to worship at Shiloh. It was commanded by God. Staying home sounded appealing, but it wasn't an option acceptable to the Lord. Guys, here is a lesson to us. We too are liable to meet a Peninnah at God's house. People at church, other people can be jealous of your fruitfulness. They can become a source of irritation and frustration and aggravation for you. And our temptation is to just stay home alone. Why should I have to put up with that Peninnah? But you see, staying home from the house of God is never an option. At least not an option acceptable to God. Hebrews 10, verse 25 instructs every believer to not forsake the assembling of ourselves together. Guys, don't let a Peninnah rob you of the fellowship and encouragement and worship and opportunities to serve that we glean when we all meet together. God knows all about Peninnah, and yet He still wants you to be involved in your church. Well, in verse 7, Hannah is so upset she can't eat. She's sulking during supper. Elkanah tries to cheer her up in verse 8. Her husband said to her, "Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? And why is your heart grieved? Am I not better to you than 10 sons?" He loved his wife, certainly. He hated to see her so upset. But Hannah arose after they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh. She went up to the tabernacle to pour out her soul to the Lord. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat by the doorpost of the tabernacle of the Lord. And she was in bitterness of soul and prayed to the Lord and wept in anguish. Then she made a vow and said, "O Lord of hosts, If you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me, and not forget your maidservant, but you will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head. Hannah asks the Lord for a baby boy, and she makes a twofold vow. First, if God answers her request, she'll see to it that this little boy serves the Lord his whole life long. She'll take him to the tabernacle, she'll turn him over to the priests, and she will enroll him in the ministry. Second, she also says that she will turn this boy, she'll take a vow, and her son will become a lifelong Nazarite. Now, you remember what a Nazarite was. Samson was a Nazarite. The Nazarite was a walking billboard for the virtues and the values of God's kingdom. It was a threefold vow. First of all, he stayed clear of the grape soda. He found his pleasure in the spiritual things, not in the physical. He never cut his locks. Attractiveness for the Nazarite was found internally, not externally. And he avoided contact with the dead, anything that was dead. His life stood for eternal, not temporal pursuits. Samson was also a Nazarite. The problem with Samson was that he had too many lapses in his timeline, too many withdrawals from godliness. Faithfulness failed to accrue in Samson's life and therefore failed to turn into character. And as a result, in times of testing, Samson yielded to temptation and ended up violating his vow. You see, it's amazing. Samson and Samuel were alike outwardly, but they were very opposite inwardly. Well, I love Hannah's prayer. Remember me and not forget your maidservant. After we got married, for 2 years, Kathy and I tried to have a child, but to no avail. And I witnessed firsthand